Today is Tuesday, June 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as infections continue to spread, the White House defends the president's use of a derogatory term to describe the coronavirus.
What the president does do is point to the fact that the origin of the virus is China.
As another black man killed by a white police officer is laid to rest, the debate over the root of systemic racism in the U.S.
The United States has been so hesitant to really reckon with our legacy of slavery because our institutions are supported by it.
Also ahead, another major celebrity concert aimed at raising big money for marginalized communities coping with the pandemic. It's all on today's International Edition. The World Health Organization reported Monday more than 183,000 new recorded cases of the coronavirus across the globe, the most in a single day since the outbreak started in December. The WHO says the numbers are troubling in Latin America and particularly Brazil. As cases rise in about a dozen U.S. states, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany Monday defended President Trump after complaints that his labeling of COVID-19 as the Kung Flu were racist.
Well, President Trump is saying, no China, I will label this virus for its place of origin.
That's what he's saying by using the racist phrase Kung Flu.
He is linking it to its place of origin.
The death toll reached over 120,000 in the United States, as at least 12 states saw record spikes, including in California, Arizona, and Florida. Joining us for analysis is Dr. Ravina Kular, infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist with the Infectious Disease Society of America. Thank you for being with us. So there were nations in Europe that really struggled to get a handle on this, and they are now doing much better. Why are we still struggling to bring this under control?
I think it's a great comparison looking at the, say, for instance, the EU. Right now, the EU is averaging about 4,000 new cases a day. Here in the U.S., we are averaging about 20,000 cases per day, and these cases are on its way up. Something to keep in mind is that the EU was in the same position as the U.S. a few months ago. Italy, Spain, France, and the U.K. And just as you stated, while the EU has suppressed the virus, the U.S. has not. And going back to your question, how did we get here? I honestly think that we as a U.S. nation in some parts of the U.S. have given up. And that just shows you that in order to tackle this pandemic, as a U.S. nation, we need to all come together. And if there are growths in Arizona, Florida, South Carolina, with there being air traffic, which is constantly there, we're going to see cases increasing in other parts of the U.S. where cases have been slowly declining.
It would appear that the president is really wanting to move on from this topic, but the pandemic has a mind of its own and is not moving on. Do we need a national strategy to address this situation?
I think we do. The fact of the matter is that in the U.S., we're still not prepared. And in order to prepare for what's to come, we have to have a homogeneous approach here as a nation. We're over 4 months into this pandemic, and we still do not have accurate testing available. There's no contact tracing, and there's no political buy-in compared to other countries.
The president over the weekend at his rally made a statement that he told officials to slow down testing because the more testing you have, the more cases. He was rebuked for that, and they are now saying that that was tongue-in-cheek. It was a joke.
I hope that was a joke. There's no way we need to slow down testing. We actually need to revamp, have more testing that's available, and actually have more accurate testing that's available. There's some tests which are only 60% accurate, you know, leaves many people in question. What do you do with that test result? So I think rather than saying we need to slow down testing, I think it's that we need to revamp more accurate testing and really support several diagnostic companies in developing more accurate testing.
What should we expect in the next few months, maybe for the rest of the summer?
I think if we do not have physical distancing in place, if we do not continue wearing masks, if we do not incorporate hand hygiene, and if we do not stay away from mass crowds, we're going to see these cases skyrocket, and we're going to see our hospitals being just completely overburdened by the number of cases, really fatal cases that are going to come in. you know, I think everyone tries to compare influenza to COVID-19, and they're very different beasts. And why there are different waves that we saw with influenza is it's dependent on the climate. And COVID-19, I don't think it is. You know, I mean, if it was, we wouldn't see areas like Florida or Arizona, which are warm climates, with cases increasing.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's also somewhat problematic here, where people are thinking that cases are going to slowly decrease during the summertime. And I think that's why people are just getting lax about some of these tactics, which have been shown to be helpful. Right now, in my mind, it's not behaving like the influenza virus at all. So I think that until we really know the behavior pattern of this virus, we still need to keep these physical distancing and masks in effect.
Dr. Ravina Kular, infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist, thank you again for being with us. The Trump administration has issued an executive order extending a ban on non-U.S. workers from entering the country. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
The Trump administration has extended a ban on green cards issued outside the United States through the end of the year. In addition, many temporary work visas have been added to the freeze, including visas used by technology companies and multinational corporations. In a presidential proclamation, President Donald Trump wrote in part, "We must remain mindful of the impact of foreign workers on the United States labor market, particularly in the current extraordinary environment." A senior official who spoke on condition of anonymity predicted the freeze will open up to 525,000 jobs for Americans. Mike Gracia, Washington.
A private funeral will be held today for Rayshard Brooks, the black man shot in the back by an Atlanta police officer outside of a Wendy's restaurant. It follows a public viewing on Monday. Brooks's June 12th death at the hands of police called on the scene because he had fallen asleep in the car further escalated tensions over racism in American policing that have been exploding since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in late May. Meanwhile, a New York police officer was suspended Sunday after a video posted online appearing to show him putting a black man in a chokehold during an arrest. New York Police Department had banned the use of chokeholds in 1993. Joining us to talk about the ongoing debate over systemic racism in the U.S. is Alexis Hoag, a civil rights and criminal defense lawyer and the inaugural practitioner in residence at the Eric H. Holder Jr. Initiative at Columbia University. Thank you so much for being with us. The viral video of George Floyd's murder seemed to really be a different sort of catalyst than we've seen. It just caught fire.
I think you can't separate it from the fact that we've been in the midst of a global pandemic. In the United States in particular, after 10, almost 11 weeks, I think we were at when the murder occurred, the country had witnessed a disproportionately high number of primarily black and brown individuals die as a result of COVID-19. And I think it really laid bare these structural inequalities that have long existed in this country. And so we can't forget that part of the equation. All of the explosive elements were there. The video circulating of the metaphorical knee to the neck on George Floyd really was the matchstick to a very volatile, flammable situation.
This movement isn't slowing down. It's getting bigger. In the midst of all this, we're seeing more black men die at the hands of police.
The immediate reforms, cosmetic changes we're seeing in police departments. Let's ban certain types of neck restraint. Let's ban chokeholds. That did not save Eric Garner. It didn't save George Floyd. And that doesn't get at the actual problem. And the actual problem is that there is a presumption of dangerousness and criminality when police officers encounter black and brown individuals. And that is a direct holdover from slavery. We have not, as a nation, had a public reckoning and reconciliation about this institution that enslaved people because they were black. We can ban certain police methods. We can ban certain police engagement of individuals, but it does not address that link between the presumption of dangerousness with a black and brown body.
This is way beyond the 60s. You're saying people in this country have not evolved to understanding that despite the fact that we now say slavery was wrong,
wrong.
It dehumanized people to the point of continuing to see them as less than?
That's correct. And the deaths from COVID-19 and the disproportionate impact that it had on Black and brown people laid bare these structural inequalities that still exist. It's not that Black people were more susceptible to COVID-19. It was that the structural inequalities that still exist from slavery as remnants, as a legacy from slavery, put Black people in a position in which they were more vulnerable. Less access to quality health care, that hyper-segregation, the inability to as effectively socially distance.
You wrote about this whole American experiment, and what can you expect when you've held people as property? How is it that after 400 years, we haven't been able to reconcile with this and live the words we say that all men are created equal? Is it getting worse, or is it just coming to light?
I hope it's not getting worse. I'd like to think that it's now being laid bare. I think that the United States has been so hesitant to really reckon with our legacy of slavery because our institutions are supported by it. Our banking institution, our criminal legal system, the way cities are planned. You can draw an unbroken thread between the institutions we operate today and how the nation formed. Slavery is part of the fabric of our country. Singular institutions like, you know, Georgetown University is now reckoning with their legacy of slavery and the fact that the Jesuit priests sold Black enslaved individuals to keep the university afloat. They are getting out in front of that history, taking steps to repair that history. That's a fantastic model, and it's uncomfortable, and it's hard, and it's public, and it's not pretty, but we as a nation have yet to do that.
Do you think that maybe part of what is happening right now is there is a new generation? They've grown up in such a diverse community of people, Black and brown and Asian. Do you think that this generation is just woke?
I think they're intimately aware of the inequalities in the world. There is a greater degree of understanding. And when you asked initially if I thought people were becoming sort of more aware, if this is increasing, and I said, you know, I have to think that people are becoming more aware. Mm-hmm. I have to be hopeful.
Right.
And some of that is tied to the work I do now at Columbia Law School. I started law school as a student 15 years ago, and the idea of abolition of police and abolition of a carceral state was not part of my vocabulary. I wanted to be a public interest lawyer within the criminal legal system. I refer to it as the criminal justice system. But my students today are starting school as self-identified abolitionists. It's not just abolition of police, it's abolition of a carceral state, so of prisons, of police, as law enforcement dictating the lives of Black and brown, mostly individuals. That gives me great hope. These Columbia law students will be in positions of power in 10 or more years. And they will be the ones making policy decisions. They will be the ones across the table from police departments monitoring their adherence to federal law and state and local law. Police officers are charged to keep us safe. People are paying attention. The world is paying attention.
Right.
I was really heartened to see mass demonstrations happening in major cities in Europe, in Asia, in South America. The media requests that I have been getting have come from Korea, Brazil, Paris, Turkey. The world is watching, and their message is also Black lives matter.
That was Alexis Hogue, a civil rights and criminal defense attorney and the inaugural practitioner in residence at the Eric H. Holder Jr. Initiative for Civil and Political Rights. Malawi's Electoral Commission has said they are confident today's presidential election rerun will be free and fair and won't see a repeat of last year's irregularities, which saw the re-election of President Peter Mutharika annulled. He's running against two other candidates. Malawi's political analysts say the race is too close to call. Lamech Messina reports from Blantyre.
Electoral Commission Chairperson Chifundo Kachale told reporters in a televised press conference Sunday that preparations for the polls has been smooth.
We are glad to report that generally the process went on smoothly, and the Commission is very grateful to all the stakeholders for the cooperation and harmonious spirit that prevailed during the whole process. Whatever issues may have arisen were able to be handled harmoniously.
However, Kachale acknowledged that COVID-19 forced the Commission to curtail some of its usual election preparation activities.
Of course, with the coming in of COVID-19 pandemic, the Commission has been forced to abandon some of the publicity strategies for public outreach, like meetings with traditional leaders, because these have a tendency to bring together a lot of people to one place, which can make the observance of physical distancing difficult at times.
The fresh pause came 4 months after the country's constitutional court annulled last year's elections over massive irregularities, a decision which the Supreme Court of Appeal upheld in May. Rights campaigners who were leading street protests against last year's results say they are confident that Tuesday's polls will be free, fair, and credible. President Mutharika appointed a new team to the Electoral Commission early this month after former chairperson Jane Ansah resigned and mandates expired for the other commissioners. Charles Kajoloweka is the executive director for a local NGO, the Youth and Society Organization. He spoke to VOA via a messaging application.
And it is also inspiring that the current commission have the leadership that seems to, you know, send a strong message that we are here to manage elections better than ever before. And with that confidence that we are seeing in the leadership and the engagement that they're doing, the transparency that they're demonstrating, we should be able to have credible elections.
Although there are three candidates, Tuesday's election is largely between President Mutharika and his main rival, Lazarus Chakwera. During last year's disputed polls, Mutharika got 38% of the vote, while Chakwera came in a close second with 35%. The Constitutional Court ordered that the winner of the Tuesday's elections must amass more than 50% of the valid votes. This forced President Mutharika, leader of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, to form alliance with the opposition United Democratic Front, whose leader Atupele Muluzi came fourth with 5% of the vote during the annulled polls. Chakwera, leader of the Malawi Congress Party, formed an alliance with 9 other opposition parties, including the United Transformation Movement, whose leader, Vice President Saulos Chilima, got 20% of the vote in the annulled election. Both Chakwera and Mutharika told their supporters during their final campaign rallies Saturday that they are confident of winning this time around. However, a recent survey by Institute of Public Opinion and Research showed Chakwera with a 20-point lead. Political analyst Sherif Kaisi told VOA Monday that the game remains unpredictable because both candidates have massive supporters from rural areas where over 80% of the population lives.
Probably the upper hand would be the one who is going to control the regions, for example. So we have the southern region, which has got 13 districts, and we have the central region with 9 districts, and finally 5 districts from the northern region. So the one who controls a larger part of the regions definitely is going to carry the day.
Mutharika comes from the southern region, while Chakwera comes from the central region. For Tuesday's election, MEC said it will use last year's voters' roll, in which about 7 million Malawians registered to vote. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Top European Union officials are holding talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Qiang, aiming to boost economic ties and ease tensions over the fallout from the coronavirus crisis and Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong. International Edition's Steve Miller talked about it with Nicolas Pinault via WhatsApp in Paris.
Well, Charles Michel, the European Council president, talked about, and I quote, open discussion and very substantive. According to him, they talked about topics that they agree and topics they disagree on. You had 4 main important areas. They talk about the economic consequences and the recovery after the COVID-19 pandemic. They also talk about the EU-China relationship, mainly the economic aspect. They also, and he said he was clearly adamant about that, they also talk about the situation of Hong Kong and the human rights. And also, finally, the fourth point that they address during this video conference, they talk about, you know, international issues.
So regarding Hong Kong, because as you mentioned, they said that this was clearly a violation of the handover protocols.
Well, Charles Mitchell said the EU expressed great concern after there is this proposed law for national security. He says EU wants to defend Hong Kong's high autonomy and relative freedom. But he said, and I quote, "Of course, we support the concept of one country, two systems." So according to him, the European Union is not going to back down on this issue. And you have also, we have to remember that China's parliament was very angry last weekend when there was an EU assembly vote containing the security law. And we know that Washington has expressed a lot of frustration with the European position, because according to the US administration, EU is not tough enough on China. And so, I mean, they really wanted to address that, because according to them, that's something that's very important for the European Union.
Nico, trade was the other big topic there. So what can you tell us about what was decided?
Well, he says that Charles Michel said it's very important to have this dynamic trade relation with China. Because, for example, China is the first trading partner with the EU. You have a 1 billion exchange by the two blocks per day, which is, of course, very important. But Charles Michel mentioned that first they need to address and solve concrete issues such as access to markets, subsidies and regulatory, and also forced technology transfer. And we also need to mention that two blocks, China and European Union, they've been talking about a big EU trade since 2014. So it's been 6 years, and so far you don't have this final agreement.
That was Paris-based reporter Nicolas Pannol speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Nuclear weapons talks between the United States and Russia started in Vienna on Monday. Little has been said officially about the arms control negotiations, but the U.S. envoy has made clear that they will be about nuclear weapons, suggesting they'll include replacing the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, also known as START, which expires in February. New Zealand police say they've seized assets worth 140 New Zealand dollars linked to a Russian man suspected of laundering billions of dollars in digital currency. They say they seized the assets because they were being held in a New Zealand company owned by a man accused of masterminding a Bitcoin laundering ring, who is wanted by both France and the United States. Outdoor apparel brand Patagonia is the latest company to put a hold on advertising on Facebook and Facebook's photo sharing app Instagram. The Stop Hate for Profit boycott campaign was started last week by several U.S. civil rights groups who say the social network has been doing too little to stop hate speech on its platforms. Lebanon is facing challenges posed by the new U.S. CSAR Act, legislation authorizing additional sanctions and financial restrictions targeting the government of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Analysts say it's because of close banking and commercial ties for decades between the two countries. Lebanon will face revising its activities as its own floundering economy is in crisis due to what critics call years of mismanagement and corruption. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Analyst Maha Yahya, who directs the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, says the CSAR Act has far-reaching implications for any entity or individual in Lebanon who has worked with Damascus because they risk sanctions.
The CSAR Act is creating considerable pressure. The first list, they're mainly Syrians affiliated directly with the Syrian regime, but it will create a lot of challenges in Lebanon. It's a pressure point on Hezbollah. It's a tool that can be brandished at any point to address anyone seeking to normalize with Syria under Bashar al-Assad, but also for many companies that have already started preparing for possibly getting involved in reconstruction in Syria.
While the Iranian-backed Shiite Hezbollah militia, also part of Lebanon's government and parliament, may be seen as the most obvious party affected by the CSAR Act, it certainly is not the only one. Joseph Bahut, an academic fellow in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, tells VOA that Hezbollah is already affected by other sanctions.
On the military issue, Hezbollah is already under watch. It will continue to act. It will probably be more shrewd and more prudent. It will not change substantially the situation.
Bahut says it is likely that Lebanon's internal security head will continue his visits to Damascus because they benefit Western powers as well. He sees the bigger impact on both countries' economies.
The Caesars Act is not as much a military issue than a commercial and trade issue, and this is where it will hit. It is hitting the Syrian economy at the core, and now you have a very strong and rapid degradation of the situation in Syria. It will hit a huge amount of macro exchanges between Lebanon and Syria, and it will probably hit Lebanon partially. For example, the deposits of Syrian figures in the Lebanese banks will be much more closely monitored. A lot of transfers will be impossible to do.
Bahut says five Lebanese banks with branches in Syria are stopping their business. Substantial trade of Lebanese products into Syria, as well as Syrian agricultural goods into Lebanon, will either be halted or go underground with smuggling, he adds. Bahut says the present Lebanese government's attempt to normalize political ties with Damascus will likely come to an end. Del Gaflek for VOA News, Amman.
VOA's International Edition continues. Pressure's growing on the presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden to embrace more progressive policies in response to the coronavirus pandemic, massive unemployment, and widespread racial inequality protests that have dramatically altered the race for the White House. As VOA's Brian Padden reports, left-leaning Democratic activists are impatient with Biden's moderate stances, and they're demanding an agenda of transformational change to energize minority and progressive voters in the November presidential election.
When former Vice President Joe Biden was a senator, he supported the 1994 crime bill that critics say targeted people of color. Now Biden, who served under President Barack Obama, is being questioned why African Americans should vote for him.
It's a legitimate concern. They should be skeptical. All I can say is show me. Watch me. I'm listening. Watch what I do. Judge me based on what I do, what I say, and to whom I say it.
Touting experienced leadership and an ability to work with Republicans, Biden clinched the Democratic Party presidential primaries, even as the coronavirus pandemic essentially shut down the campaign. Biden won with strong support from African Americans and older Americans. Yet many young progressives back Senator Bernie Sanders, an advocate for expansive government programs to provide universal health care, free college education, and increased benefits for the working class. To defeat President Donald Trump in the upcoming presidential election, Biden will need both key groups to vote in large numbers.
No justice, no peace!
But the eruption of widespread racial inequality protests, along with the coronavirus pandemic and loss of millions of jobs, have intensified calls for sweeping change. Biden's bipartisan approach is facing new scrutiny from social justice activists that they say too often capitulated to Republican demands.
Biden has had a very long career and taken positions over 40 years or so, some of which are not very progressive today, not very popular progressives.
Expectations are growing that Biden will pick an African-American female running mate. But that may not be enough to rally progressives who want Biden to endorse criminal justice reforms under the defund the police slogan that would restrict police powers. They also want Biden to embrace universal health care advocated by Sanders, as well as aggressive policies to combat economic inequality.
There just isn't an option to not do anything or to be, you know, or to even just kind of nibble away at the problem. I think in order to solve this problem, it requires bold policy.
While progressives may be dissatisfied with Biden, they remain united in opposition to Trump.
Well, I think at the very end of the day, Biden is going to capture progressive support, partly because it has nowhere else to go.
In a recent national poll, Biden holds a significant 13-point lead, with only 35% of respondents saying they would support Trump. But analysts say infighting among Democrats or an upturn in the economy could change the dynamics of the race back in Trump's favor. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
Miley Cyrus, Shakira, and Usher are among the many music and film stars from around the world headlining a globally televised and streaming online fundraiser concert Saturday to help raise billions of dollars in donations to help ease the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on marginalized communities. The initiative, Global Goal Unite for Our Future, is a joint effort by the European Union and the advocacy group Global Citizen. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for being with us.